Salmon and Dusk, a series of podcasted stories written and read by Mike Bartlett. Story 2, Out of the Picture, Chapter 2. The black cab met Joe and Kilby on the corner, despite clearly being the same vehicle seen on the first floor some minutes earlier, receiving attention from the same man who now sat on the driver's seat. Kilby bundled Joe into the back and briskly gave the address to the driver, who turned back with a scowl. I told you, leave off the chauffeur routine, yeah? And don't spare your shoe leather, Kilby persisted. The driver, later introduced as Nero Dusk, sulked about the small confines of Joe's studio, while his partner squatted before the vacant canvas. Lips pursed, his chin rested on the worn knees of his pinstripes. Eventually he sniffed, stood up, and began concentrating only on rolling himself another cigarette. Joe watched with impatience. He was still waiting for the punchline, for the hidden camera, for a teenager in a sharp suit, sneakers, and unlikely haircut to step forward from the shadows, brandishing the card of some cutting-edge PR company. Well? Kilby sniffed again. Well, what? It's escaped, isn't it? Looks like you should have listened to me the other night, whatever I was saying. Now it's front page bad news. Arms not unfolding, Joe nodded, playing along. Bad news how exactly? Well, you've let something out into the world that isn't supposed to be there, Mr. Miller. Things that aren't supposed to be in the world tend to cause a lot of problems for things that are. Things like you, me, and the great unwashed. Right, we're still going with this, are we? My paintings are so good, they've got a life of their own. Is that it? Well, it's a surreal idea, I'll give you that. But I've got representation. I'm not looking for new PR. Kilby frowned. PR? He looked to his partner, who glanced over a turned shoulder. Public relations, innit? Thinks you want to sell him to the masses. Oh. Kilby seemed disappointed, sinking into the solitary armchair in the corner of the room. I thought we were past all that. This isn't a scam, Mr. Miller. This is me being serious. He plucked at the knot at his collar. This is my serious tie. Joe wasn't ready to give ground. You must have sent someone in last night, yeah? To swap the paintings? How'd they get in? Nothing's broken. Kilby slouched further back in his chair, still giving the construction of his cigarette far more attention than his conversation, his tone bored and slightly irritated, as if having to repeat himself unreasonably. What you have to understand, Miller, he said, is that anything's possible, even the worst things. In the old days, some things were real and some weren't, but the whole world has changed and you never noticed. There used to be order, now it's a free-for-all. All those things that should never have existed are creeping their way out into the world. Luckily, you found yourself the one detective in London who deals with this sort of thing. I also do a very nice line in Cheating Husbands. He glanced up at Joe. That's probably not as much use to you. Joe didn't say anything immediately. It wasn't the sort of conversation he had any experience in, and suspected he was too sober to plunge in wholeheartedly. He found his cynicism thinning even as he sought to bolster it. There was something in Kilby's bland summary of extraordinary things that made it difficult to disbelieve. He gave no effort, strived for no notes of drama, merely rattled off absurdities as if reciting a shopping list, as if these things were simply ordinary and true. It was the same easy air with which he told Joe never to pick up a paintbrush again. Still, Joe couldn't quite shake the feeling that this ease covered a precise intent. The man was conning him. "You gave me your card," he said. You said I'd come see you in 3 days. Kilby afforded him polite attention. Yes. Told me I'd do something terrible. That's right. Kilby seemed to be waiting for the point. So you put the idea in my head. I only painted what I painted because you told me not to. You set it up. If Kilby felt the weight of accusation, it seemed not to trouble him. Well, peace and quiet is all very well, Mr. Miller. But it doesn't exactly fill my pockets. I can't just sit around waiting for business to come my way. Joe shook his head. Sure, now he had the mechanics of the con dismantled. Kilby, it seemed, had planted the suggestion of painting something unusual, perhaps careful with his wording to subconsciously specify an empty frame. Joe had seen reality programs in which magicians transformed guileless pensioners into prize-winning card sharks. Kilby, or whoever he was, had come to him at a moment of weakness, when his mind might have been vulnerable to such manipulations. The more Joe thought about it, the angrier he became. This is bullshit. I think I've heard enough. Kilby jumped to his feet, ready to go and not bothered about it. Suit yourself. Just remember that we've accepted your case, Mr. Miller. Sooner or later, you'll need us. I don't need anything from you, except the door closing behind you. Kilby nodded briskly, both his coat and his partner trailing him out, closing the door to the studio behind him. When they were gone, Joe picked up the empty portrait and studied brushwork and frame for signs of forgery or trickery. His determined disbelief was already giving way. If there was any forgery, he realized, it would be no less miraculous in its perfection than a painting finding the exit. Greasy waters in his gut. He knew he had to speak to someone about this. Someone who would cut through the fantasies gaining colour around him. He wanted to be chopped down to size, made ridiculous and insignificant. There was still only one person he knew who could do that. She didn't answer the phone, but that was to be expected. His numerous unwelcome calls of late had set a precedent. He took a cab, reassured by the tedious advertising scrawl across its more modern curves, to a new flat in Hoxton, and stood some minutes in the rain, watching the light in her second-floor window. Two shadows moved across the glass. He considered getting back in the cab and returning home, but brake lights were already staining the downpour near the lights on the corner. Cold water traced the veins in his temple and neck until he was angry and shameless enough to climb four flights and batter the frosted glass in her front door. The lights of a Christmas tree twinkled as if from the depths. He could see both of them in silhouette, but neither moved toward him. The outlines of gestures suggested an argument, and Joe continued hammering the frosting, hoping to encourage it. "I'll make this difficult," he thought, "until it looks enough like a mistake." The sentiment wasn't new, but until that moment, it had simmered unthought. Another thud with his fist and he heard her scream, a noise he had never heard, which shoved up the volume in his chest, loud music playing as, not once thinking about it, he kicked in the front door. It took 14 blows with his sodden trainers to splinter the wood, and then he ran, calling her name, down the short and narrow hall to the small and narrow lounge at its end. She was gone. The room was empty. A record spun unattended on his old turntable, the one he replaced when deciding she wasn't coming back. He called her name again. Nothing. From the street below, a siren. The window was open, rain shattering across the sill. A jolt of nausea, and Joe ran across to it, sticking his head out and fearing the worst. A dark figure on the pavement looked up at him, as if waiting for his attention. His long leather coat glistened in the downpour, eyes as bright as brake lights. Another smaller figure stood nearby, taking shaky, uncertain steps. Joe knew her, even as he knew it wasn't her. A gesture from the first man, and both ran off toward the traffic lights, dissolving in the rain. Joe turned to the painting he knew hung above the bookcase. She had kept the picture, allowing Joe to believe she still needed a piece of him close at hand, despite every denial. It wasn't the same picture. Not anymore. The frame was the same, bought from a stall on Portobello Road, originally framing an appalling beige print of some boat or other, moored on an estuary. He had replaced it 3 years ago with a portrait of her, her dark hair far longer than the current, carefully styled crop. There had been a smile on lips she had painted bright red for the occasion. Now she was still in the frame, but wearing a t-shirt he had never seen, a heavy frown across a forehead revealed by a brief fringe. Pale and frightened, her familiar, fantasized features trapped beneath his own enamel strokes. There was a note, left on the back of a supermarket receipt, atop the bookshelves. "She'll come for you," it read, "just as you remember her." Joe went back to the Albion the next morning. This time Kilby was dressed in the same leather jacket and jeans in which Joe had first seen him, his lips detailed with red wine tannin. He swayed slightly as he finished off a bottle of the same plonk they had served at the exhibition opening. Another 6 identical bottles were arranged haphazardly across the bar top. A recurring parishioner of the free drinks himself, Joe couldn't disapprove of such thievery. There was no sign of the black cab, remembered by a scuffed patch of floorboard stained with smeared rubber and engine grease. Kilby read the note Joe had found in Scarlett's apartment and folded it into a waistcoat pocket. "I'll get on to it in the morning," he promised. "It is the morning." Kilby squinted at the windows. Low grey cardboard over Camden, but definitely daylight. "Ah, yeah." He squinted at the wine glass in his hand. "Would you prefer tea, then? I didn't bring any milk." "Shame." Joe wasn't in the mood for trivialities.
"So she's in on it. Is that it? This was her idea, maybe."
Kilby seemed confused. "What are you talking about?"
"She must have posed for that other painting. Why? I didn't think she cared. Not anymore."
With some understanding, Kilby retrieved the note from his waistcoat and put it down on the desktop, tapping it with a long finger. "This she.
We used to make life difficult for each other. Argued about anything. TV, dirty dishes, art, travel. When we stopped arguing, I knew it was over."
"Oh." Kilby's face slipped. "You think this is a domestic?"
"I hate to disappoint you, but she, whoever she is, has nothing to do with this. By the sound of it, she's not up to doing much at all right now except peer out from her frame."
Joe still wasn't buying it.
"I saw 2 people through the glass." "How'd you do that?" "I checked the whole flat."
"Jesus." Kilby stood up sharply, kicking his chair over in post-boozy irritation. Both hands came down and gripped the edge of his desk.
"Look, mate, I do enough domestics. Bore me rigid. Now, you want to look cool and cynical? That's fine. You're an artist. You've got a reputation to keep. Frankly, I don't care. I'll take survival over street cred. But you keep up all this denial, and you'll be seeing your paintings shoot up in value with no way for you to cash in."
He wasn't angry, Joe realized. Just frustrated. Maybe he didn't care enough to be angry. Maybe he wasn't selling anything after all.
"So what? My painting's going around, letting his mates out and trapping mine. What are you going to do about it?"
Kilby straightened his tie and sat down, boots swinging up onto the desk. "I've got contacts. Well, a contact. But she knows a thing or two. At least that's what I tell her. Otherwise she gets a bit bolshy." Kilby paused, watching Joe over the rim of a glass en route to his bottom lip. "We'll find your painting before he lets anyone else out." He gave a brief, reassuring smile, then sniffed.
"In the meantime, you'll need looking after." "Seriously?"
Kilby shoved the note back across the tabletop. "Says she'll come for you. Reads like a threat from where I'm sitting."
"You want me to pay you for protection from my own painting?"
If Kilby had an answer, he was saved from sharing it. Searing light and a thunderous crash had Joe briefly blinded, and wondering if a bomb had gone off on the street below. As both glare and noise subsided, he realized the black cab was now parked askance to his right, engine gurgling
and tires steaming. Nero opened the driver's door, slammed it behind him, and paying no attention to the onlookers, quickly had the hood up. Joe's jaw was circling. "That's..." He shut his mouth. He had been about to say, "impossible," but the word seemed to have lost its currency.
He had taken the portrait from her flat the night she went into it, cut it at home through the rain, wrapped in 3 Sainsbury's bags. Since then, it had sat at a slim angle atop his bookshelf, and he had rarely looked at anything else. Again tonight, he stood with his knees before an assortment of modern fiction, and watched the girl who couldn't do anything but watch him back. She didn't look happy about it. Still, it was all he could do not to touch fingertips to the brushstrokes, in case the paint shifted, and she was dispelled or disfigured. "She was happy," Joe said. "The day I painted this, I mean." He instantly corrected himself. "The original version, that is. It was the only time she ever sat for me. Usually she would writhe and whinge and bitch. Said she didn't like the idea of seeing what I saw in her. Didn't want an official version out there, pinned down forever like some extinct butterfly. That's how she talked, seriously."
"Uh-huh."
Kilby sat in the large warehouse window, as he had all afternoon, watching the street below through a pair of cracked, tortoiseshell wayfarers, chin in palm, bored lips pursed. Occasionally he remembered to entertain his client, at which point he had raised an opinion or anecdote with the full force of an entertainer mid-routine. Afterwards he would become distracted and hum to himself until next remembering he had company. Nero had refused to go anywhere until he had, in his own words, showered, shat, and shaved. An argument along corridors and up staircases had ensued, ended only by a compromise on Kilby's part that he was now, somewhat desperately, smoking his way through. "Don't you worry about those?" Joe asked, as Kilby lit his 8th. Kilby looked at him with some surprise or disappointment. "You're an artist, aren't you? It's all smack and crack and cirrhosis with your lot, isn't it? You're telling me you're worried about a few fags." "Didn't used to be. She stopped me smoking. Hated it. Said she wouldn't nurse me if I was dying." He frowned. "My dad had lung cancer." "I know I'm not going to. Got a glimpse of the future. Kind of kills any incentive to quit." Kilby frowned, realizing he had missed a cue. "Sorry about your dad." Joe shrugged. "No one lives forever, right? You're a right ray of sunshine, aren't you?" Kilby went back to looking out the window. 5 minutes later, he checked his watch. A minute after that, he checked it again. Stifled a yawn. Nero arrived to relieve Kilby around 6, didn't say much to anyone, then fell asleep in one of the mismatched armchairs halfway through news night. He was already awake when Joe surfaced at 10 the next morning, and spent most of the next 2 hours waiting to be relieved in turn. Around midday, a phone call told Nero that Kilby was pursuing other inquiries and wouldn't be back. Yesterday's argument resumed in a brief and, from Nero's perspective, doomed form, after which the phone went down hard. The rest of the day mostly passed in silence. Nero said little other than a few grumbled judgments on the qualities of both his partner and Joe's record collection. When Joe took a walk to the corner shop, Nero came with him without invitation or explanation, staying just behind Joe's right shoulder on the street and, in the shop, a few items down the shelf. After dark, around 8, Nero came in with 2 mugs of milky coffee and shoved one into Joe's hand. Wordlessly, he sank again into an armchair, clutching his own mug. Joe took a seat in the other chair, and for some minutes, both watched their reflections on the blank screen of the television. Deciding silence was harder work than conversation, Joe volunteered, "You do this sort of thing all the time?" Nero didn't seem surprised by this abrupt resumption of conversation, more resigned. "There ain't no this kind of thing," he grunted. "Just things that aren't your kind of thing, right?" "Sorry?" "Don't be," Nero shrugged and sipped his coffee. The mug didn't move from his mouth for a minute. Then the scowl that had sat atop his dark eyes for at least a week finally relented.
"We don't fit in," Nero said, almost a sigh. "So we deal with shit that don't fit in."
"Like paintings that come to life?"
"Whatever. It's stuff that ain't supposed to happen. People like you don't notice most times. When you do, you stop fitting in. For a week, then it's business as usual, yeah? For us, there ain't no business as usual."
Joe wondered if Nero was determined to feel sorry for himself. And maybe Nero wondered the same thing, because he sat up in his chair and rearranged his shoulders.
"Whatever,"
he added. "I never wanted the usual," Joe told him, by way of reassurance. And as he kept talking, trying to keep back the silence, he heard himself say things he had never thought, things he realized that were true and vital. "I spent most of my time wanting to be unusual, wanting things to be different, myself too, I guess. That's why I started painting. Then finally my paintings do change things. At least, they start to."
"They learn to walk."
Joe smiled, wondered if the gruff man in the well-shined shoes had made a joke.
"Yeah, but that's not what I meant. I meant, I get an agent, I get an exhibition, I get money and attention."
"Lucky you."
"Yeah.
But one thing comes in, something else falls out. Then all I want is for things to change back, but things don't change back. The moment's gone. You can't recreate it."
Nero nodded toward the shelf, a brisk semi-gesture. "The ex."
"Yeah. In the days when I was hopelessly poor, she liked me more."
"Right. Kilby said you went on about her."
Beat and Nero seemed to regret his brusqueness, frowned with something approaching empathy.
"Tough, yeah?"
More silence, but this was more comfortable. Again, Joe spoke first. "What happened to you, to make you unusual?"
Nero studied his coffee, as if committing it to memory. Maybe he would have said something if the lights hadn't then gone out, plunging the flat into darkness. The last Joe saw of Nero, he was on his feet, in a stance remembered from other fights or flights. When the lights came back up, Gray was there, his charcoal hand clutched at Nero's throat, lifting him off the ground. The smaller man flailed and kicked and choked, but Gray seemed not to notice. He turned to Joe, his expression only curious.
"Am I strong?"
he asked.
"I don't understand."
"Oh, come on, boss. I'm a piece of you, after all. You know how strong I am." "I think I'm strong. Strong enough to squash this man's throat like it was last week's breadstick, yeah?"
Nero, spluttering speechless, glared at Joe, implored him.
"I can feel his pulse in his neck, flexing his skin. It's a good beat there, I can tell you. You could dance to it."
"Put him down," Joe said, a little weakly.
"I'm clever. I worked that out. And I'm good with words. Better than you, maybe. I think I'm cooler than you, too. I think you knew that when you painted me. There I was, an avatar for your missing cool. So I'm clever and cool, but am I strong? Stronger than you?"
"No," Joe said.
"No, you're not,"
Gray tuttered.
"You're lying."
Almost casually, he threw Nero and the coffee mug he was still clutching across the room so that both collided with three careful, careless piles of CDs. The back of Nero's head cracked against the wall, and when he hit the floorboards, he didn't get up again. Joe stared where he was, only looked to Gray.
"I don't believe this. This is insane. I should be waking up."
Gray smiled. It was a dirty, oily thing to behold, like the revelation of some perversion or other.
"Wake up, Joe,"
he taunted.
"What do you want? What did I ever do to you?" "You made me. The first thing you ever made. Before that, you're a camera snapping away, giving people themselves the way you see them. One morning, I'm in your head. And then wham! You've created. There's nothing, No one like me anywhere. You gave something back.
I let you out, Joe said slowly, remembering what Kilby had told him that first night. Something awful.
Oh, careful, boss, you'll insult me.
But Gray smiled. He moved about, prowling, never far from Joe, a circling beast hypnotizing his prey.
Now, you ask me what I want. I don't want to hurt you, if that's what's worrying you. How could I hurt you? I am you.
What?
Told you. I'm your avatar, man. Hard, clever, and fuck-off cool. Here I am. All I want now is for you to do what you do.
And what's that? Gray tuttered.
I'm the yin to your yang, boss. The sour to your sweet. You put them in, I'll take them out. Follow?
Follow what? Taking what out? Gray dropped into the armchair Nero had recently vacated. He watched Joe, maybe hoping he would not need an answer. Eventually, he shook his head.
They'll all want to be part of it. It's a weapon in the right hands. Vanity. They know they're decaying. They know they're past it. We'll offer them a way out. Immortality.
What are you talking about?
You showed me how. It's how I got here. Your empty frame. They get in, their portrait gets out. The portrait stays perfect, living all that nothingness ahead, while they stay on canvas, safe forever. Most people are happy enough living vicariously.
Gray seemed tired by Joe's shock and disapproval, as if they were merely formalities he was in a hurry to dispense with.
Look, boss, it's not much of a world out there. Not anymore. People can't wait to kill each other for things no one with half a brain would believe in. Soon enough, whole cities will be in ruins. Already you're seeing towers crashing in flame and dust. Hurricanes of pulverized glass and concrete. Mountains that hid under ice for 10,000 years are drying and cracking in the sun. Every bastard on the planet drives a machine that's killing it.
He drove a long finger toward the ceiling, circling.
This gaff is running out of time, man. But we'll save who we can. For posterity, yeah?
He grinned broadly.
That's where you come in.
Me?
Well, can't do it alone, can I? I need you to get a painting. You paint a portrait, I'll do the swap.
Sorry, what? You want me to paint everyone?
Hey, it's not going to be quick, I know that. But we're only talking about anyone who's anyone. Fuck the dross, man. There's no helping them.
Joe laughed. Once with caution, then again with intent. You're insane.
Am I? You tell me, boss. You created me. Did you want to be insane? Maybe it's easier for you that way, yeah?
He jumped out of his seat, leather coat curling about his thighs. He pointed a finger between Joe's eyes.
Think about it, man. Save the good, good people, yeah? While there's time.
He turned, but only just. The portrait on the bookshelf caught his eye, and he smirked.
Left that one too late, didn't you? I did you a right favour.
What was that? Gray ignored him, walking through to the bedroom. When Joe followed, he found the room empty and his window open. Curtains flicked and snapped in apparent irritation. He checked on Nero, who was still breathing, and felt guilty for not doing so immediately. Or maybe he felt embarrassed. Or both. Mostly he felt ridiculous, shown up by his own invention. He had been stymied by fear, allowed himself to forget everything but himself, trapped by Gray's mad rhetoric. In the aftermath, he was left only with self-pity. Had he created Gray as a way out for himself? A portrait of a man who wouldn't be touched by those things that had left so much scar tissue? He lightly slapped Nero's cheek, wanting reassurance, wanting expert advice.
Hey, wake up.
Nero didn't. Joe wondered if he should call an ambulance. He was still wondering when she called his name, and he realized she was standing behind him, her long, dark hair curled about her bare shoulders. Without thinking, he checked the picture. Maybe, he thought, for a moment, she had escaped. Maybe she had found her way back to him and found herself wanting to see him. This other Scarlet, her portrait,
turned to follow his gaze, scowled, then looked back to him, disappointed.
"She's gone," she said, "but I came back."
Salmon and Dusk, Out of the Picture, continues next week. If you're enjoying the podcast, drop by www.mikebartlett.com and leave a message on the forum. You might be interested in After Dusk, a behind-the-scenes podcast, in which I ramble on about the processes by which Salmon and Dusk have been brought back to the world of podcasting. Hope you've enjoyed this week's episode. I'll see you next week.